today's class is going to be a bit more chaotic than the last few classes, the next few classes. I want to sort of transition, and I want to do a number of different things. So the first thing I want to do today is just step back and say some things about what we've been talking about the last few classes. Cartesian skepticism, Kantian skepticism. What are these labels for? What is their interest? What is their scope? How do they relate to each other? So I want to say some things about that. And that's what I'll do for the first half. And also address some objections that came up over the last few classes that I was deferring till today to keep my promises. And then the second half of today, what I want to do is then start trying to give us a more operational way of identifying whether something's a form of Cartesian or Kantian skepticism by breaking it down into features, each of these into what I would call features of each of these genres of skepticism. And once one tries to do this, what you're doing is itself philosophically more complicated than it might appear at first. So I'll say some things about what we're doing in trying to do that. And then towards the end of today, I want to begin to start talking about C.I. Lewis as an example of a certain kind of Kantian skeptic, who I think is very instructive. And then on Wednesday, we will continue that discussion. So we're a little behind with respect to your syllabus, which might not be a bad thing. It means that you're on top of the reading. Okay, so first topic I want to say about these kinds of skepticism is that if you look across areas of philosophy, sometimes you'll notice that people are clearly concerned with a kind of Cartesian skepticism. In philosophy perception, other minds are very clear cases of this. In other areas of philosophy, at least today, in contemporary philosophy, you'll notice people are much more concerned with another of these forms. For instance, the philosophy of language, especially the influence of Kripke's work and others, the focus is on what we were calling in last class Kantian skepticism about meaning. How is it so much as possible that a sign could mean something? How could there be a fact of the matter, as Kripke puts it, about whether I'm adding or quadding? So one thing you might conclude from this is, well, for some areas of philosophy, one kind of skepticism is the shape that skeptical problems take. For another kind of area of philosophy, the other kind of skepticism is the kind that problems take. I think implicitly lots of people seem to be drawn to some such conclusion in various things they say. So one reason I went to the trouble for the five areas we talked about to distinguish a variant of Kantian skepticism with respect to each and a variant of Cartesian skepticism with respect to each and then a variant of Kantian skepticism with respect to each is that I want to say, no, that's not right. And I even want to make a philosophical claim now. This is a strong claim, really quite a strong claim. We could spend the whole class just discussing this claim. There'll be opportunities to discuss it as we go along. Here's the claim. I want to say wherever one of these forms of skepticism is possible, the other is possible. It's a philosophical claim. It's not a sociological claim. It might be that if you look in the philosophy of law, so far, people have mostly been very concerned about how do they know this precedent is correct. You could have a ruling which everyone takes to be correct and has been taken to be correct for a long time, and then it's suddenly overturned. And you can generate a Cartesian recital about how we know that legal rulings and relationship between legal decisions and precedents are correct. Is it really the right rule? And in this particular area, in this particular community, people who do philosophy of law aren't worried about Kantian skepticism about law. They aren't worried about the question which we might put like this. How is it that we could take a legal norm to be binding at all? How is it that we could so much as think that what someone did then has a legal bearing on what we must do now. How could this relation of accord between the previous ruling and the present ruling even so much as be incorrect? On the whole, for various reasons we could discuss, people in law school haven't faced that question much. But the point isn't what people who are writing about philosophy of law have said. The question is, if you've got one of these philosophical problems, does it in some sense require the possibility of the other being formulatable, and once formulatable, bringing its problems in its train? And I want to say in either direction, if you have one of these forms of skepticism, then the other is plausible. So that's a claim about areas of philosophy where one rather than the other seems more pressing. That isn't to say that there aren't reasons why one isn't more pressing than the other. Sociological, historical, even philosophical reasons. But it's a claim about the shape of the problems. A second thing I want to say, and this is even more possibly crazy, I don't myself quite know whether what I'm about to say is true. I don't know how to test it, except to give many, many examples and to think about it. But what I want to say is anything that's recognizable as an area of philosophy is an area of thought in which these sorts of skeptical problems can arise. And even something like, in some sense, have arisen, because we can see the kinds of answers that are being given as implicitly involving a response to these kinds of worries, one or the other of these kinds of worries, however inchoately the worry itself is articulated. So that's a claim about areas of philosophy. So it follows from that the five examples that we've been talking about, from perception, philosophy of mind, philosophy of language, philosophy of action, philosophy of art, are just examples. In principle, we could just spend the rest of the, next whatever's left, 7-8 meetings of this class, just going through examples. I don't think that'd be the best way to use the time, but we can do it. I think there are a number of very interesting examples that are worth comparing to the ones that we have talked about. I thought I would just mention a few of these quickly, ones that I think aren't as obviously versions of the two we've talked about. Oh, thanks. The two we've talked about, but I think are also have exactly the same structure. Let me think about what order to do this in. One area is that's come up a few. I also mention these because I think when we were first discussing skepticism in the first class, when we were trying to just talk about straightforward Cartesian skepticism about the external world or about other minds, it started turning into other problems sometimes. So it's worth having some of these before one. One kind is in the area of philosophy, which you might call philosophy of testimony, for lack of a better name for it. Or if you want a more fancy name for this that brings out how it relates to other areas, we might call this second personal knowledge. Third personal knowledge is, how can I know he is in pain? First personal knowledge has to do with things about what I can't help but believe, according to Descartes. For instance, I'm seeing something, but how do I know what I can't help but believe is really true, whether I really am in a class? Well, second personal knowledge is somebody tells me something. Naturally, before we do philosophy, we come to think of this as a way of acquiring knowledge, too. If I think of a lot of the things I know, the northernmost university in the world is in Tromsø. Oslo is the capital of Norway. Almost everything I know about Norway, for starters. How do I know it? I've never been to Oslo. I've never been to Tromsø. It's not observational knowledge. I know it because someone told me or I read it somewhere. And in most cases, I take the capitals of the 50 American states. I don't remember who told me or where I read it. I might have been quite small when I first learned that Oslo is the capital of Norway. The Americans usually have to get pretty old before they learn things like that. But at any rate, I have a great deal of stuff in my head, which we normally think of as knowledge, but I have acquired it, if you will, by hearsay. Someone has told me that. Now, it's very easy to construct a Cartesian scenario that goes, well, the evidence could all be the same, but it's not true. You know, all of the evidence says that, you know, Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. But who's providing the evidence? Probably some of you know the novel 1984 by George Orwell. It's, you know, a very powerful thought experiment about how knowledge by testimony could be extremely faulty. It could be very coherent. You could read it. You could find out that right now we're at war with such and such, and we've won these battles and so forth. But the facts could be otherwise. So it's very easy to construct a Cartesian scenario. Here, the argument of illusion goes, all of your testimonial knowledge for X could be identical to what it is right now, but the fact itself could be otherwise. So now what's on the near side of the gap is what people tell us, the substance, the testimony. What's on the far side of the gap is that which the testimony is for. It's very easy to structure something that has a structure of a Cartesian argument from illusion. It's very easy to start saying, it's always possible that, and so on. Sometimes you need a bit of imagination to do it, but you can do it. And you certainly can easily construct best cases where this has happened, especially if you think about things like the former Soviet Union or the Spanish Civil War. Unfortunately, with respect to this, you have real historical examples. You don't just need thought experiments. You actually have photographs, you know, where Trotsky has been airbrushed out of all the photographs. You can have lots of evidence that he wasn't there. Yeah, things are otherwise. So it will exactly fit into the Cartesian format we've looked at for the other problems. Is a best case. Is a ground for now. There's an argument for illusion. It generalizes precipitously for all knowledge of this class, and so on, all the way down the Cartesian format. Similarly, that can raise a problem, which is increasingly actually the issue in contemporary philosophy of testimony, which is a more Kantian problematic, which is, how could somebody's telling me something so much as be a form of knowledge? Isn't that always, at best, you know, a form of probification, a form of better grounded opinion? So what happens is it starts looking like the paradigms of knowledge are something like perception and inference. And actually the tendency in philosophy of testimony is to explain how testimony is knowledge. If you get the right combination of people perceiving things and sound inferences, you can deduce it, mediated by testimony. And actually most of this debate, I think, actually winds up conceding skepticism, that is, testimony ceases to look like a possible kind of knowledge at all. And that's, so I think, increasingly, the tendency in philosophy of testimony is towards a Kantian problematic, where it looks like testimony can't even be a kind of knowledge. How could it be? What's interesting about this case, which is why I mention it, is that unlike other areas of philosophy, the tendency is to actually concede the conclusion of the Kantian skeptic and say, maybe testimony isn't a kind of knowledge. It's just a mechanism. The only kinds of knowledge are first personal and third personal. There is no distinctively second personal. It's hard to get away with that. We're talking about perception or inference. It looks like we need these. You might think you can actually just give up on this one. But the actual problematics themselves are the same. I spent too much time on that example. Let me do the other ones a little more quickly. Here's another whole area of philosophy. Issues about personal identity. But they really turn on issues of memory in this issue, in this literature. Derek Parfit is famous for making examples of these kinds of cases. Say I clone Richard. And more importantly, his double has all of his memories. His memories are exactly the memory he has right now. And then say, Richard gets sadly sick. He's going to die. So we put him out of his misery. We shoot Richard. we bring his double in. We need Richard. We can't live without Richard. What the class would be a terrible show without his teachings. So we bring the double in. We have the new Richard Sirley. But actually, this is the new Richard Sirley. That all happened this morning. And say we ask Richard, are you the double? Or are you the original Richard? Well, Richard doesn't. His memories are what his memories would be. He's all the same. So Parfit says, what it is to be Richard, this is a version of Barclayanism, you might say, with respect to personal identity. So skepticism is, how do I know that I am really me, or I'm just something or somebody who has the same memories? That's the skeptical worry. Parfit's answer to that skeptic, he never motivates as a separate form of skepticism, but I think you can see once you put it that way, it's a form of Cartesian skepticism, just like the other ones. And then Parfit quickly jumps to Barclay's answer, the SES Percipi version of the answer in philosophy of perception. He says, what it is to be Richard just is to have those memories. But the point is, you have a structure of the argument from illusion there. If you can't tell the difference from within, on a certain understanding of within, then what could the difference consist of? And you have a certain skeptical recital. And there's a corresponding Kantian problematic, which Hume first started to make urgent by asking, what is it so much as to be a self? How could we be anything other than just a mere collection? What is the unity of the self? Such a, it could start looking like the answer is not the Cartesian answer, where you know the difference between, it's clear to you that you seem to be a unified self, but how do I know I'm really the one I think I am? That's an issue about identity, existence, really. But what's taken for granted on the Cartesian side, as always, is questioned the Kantian side. And the question is, how could there so much as seem to be something which is a self that's unified with respect to anything? Say, what are the conditions of the possibility of that? And Kant himself, made that an urgent question, the paralogisms. So that's a form of Kantian skepticism you actually do find in Kant. But again, there's a Cartesian version and a Kantian version. Sorry I did that so quickly, but there's many things to discuss. Maybe just two other examples, because I think, again, it's useful to know very different issues all have the same form. It's a philosophical issue which we might call, this isn't discussed as much in philosophy, it's not a fashionable topic. I think it's very useful, though, to see how it has the same form, because it helps one see how these gaps, these Cartesian and Kantian gaps, they can come up in very different sorts of ways. So a problem about the reality of the past, it's a little bit like testimony, only there's no testimony in this example. It can be my own first personal evidence. The issue about the reality of the past is, how do I know that something really happened in the past? How can we have knowledge of the past? The point could be about testimony. We can know everything we do about Hannibal, but he never crossed the Alps. It's just a myth. Turns out it's like the Iliad. Maybe if you think the Iliad's true, it's like Atlantis, whichever one that people thought was true that's not now. Or it could be an issue about your own memories. But the question is, it starts looking like, in this way, it's like the testimony case. I'm never actually presented with the past. My knowledge of the past is always in the present. And now you can generate a Cartesian format. Everything with respect to the present could have exactly the disposition it does now, but how things actually were in the past could be different than they are now. So it looks like the past fact can blankly obtain in a way that is, given what is available to me, the present, always transcendent with respect to that. And so you can always generate a Cartesian problematic. Isn't it possible that you don't? And then it can start looking like knowledge of the past can never really be knowledge. Again, it can at best be well-grounded opinion or probability or highly probable. And again, you can generate a Kantian problematic here. People haven't generally, but there's nothing, once you've set it up this way, to keep yourself from worrying about how can we so much as make sense of knowledge of the past. It can start looking like, given the premises the Cartesian is using, that knowledge, as Bertrand Russell put it once, can only be of what is immediately present to one. And the very idea of knowledge of the past is a contradiction in terms. You can have guesses about the past, you can have highly well-grounded guesses, but you can actually have knowledge of it. One last case, because I picked this one, though I think it's much less intuitive, and historically it doesn't have the same pedigree. These are all rather old philosophical problems, actually, that have become, the form of skepticism with respect to them has become more and more articulate in certain ways, but you can go back to the ancients and find philosophical worries of all these three sorts. This is something much more specific that comes out of post-Phrygian philosophy. But I think it's worth mentioning because it'll come up in some of our readings. And so it's worth seeing that it has exactly the same form again. It has to do with issues about philosophy of reference. There's many ways you can generate this, but let's generate this with respect to issues of singular demonstrative thought. So I say something like, that person, blah, 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 blah. Or, the liquid in his glass is champagne, to take a famous example from the literature, or whatever. And it can turn out I was wrong. That is, what I thought I was referring to is not what I was referring to. But things could have been exactly as they seem to me to be, and I could have either been referring correctly or referring incorrectly. So the basis on which my act of reference was made, this is where the Cartesian scenario is generated, looks like does not suffice to secure successful reference, or does not suffice to guarantee the avoidance of a failure of reference. This is often done in the contemporary literature as a distinction between sense and reference. So, sense is understood, and I want to say this now quite clearly, just to make it clear, I'm not giving you my views about anything, including my views about Frege. I'm giving you something that's in the philosophical literature. Sense here is understood as a mode or a way of presentation, where this is understood in Cartesian terms. So the sense, the way of presentation is how things are to me, how things present themselves to me. So sense looks like it's on my side of a gap. How things, and this often goes with some analytic philosophers saying sense is a psychological matter ultimately. The sense of a term differs for different people, depending upon psychological facts about it in which they perceive things. It's a complete mystery in Frege, I might add, who's a kind of Kantian, we could say. But leave that aside. So here, sense is understood as how things are to me. The reference is how things are in the world, what I'm actually picking up. And then it looks like the sense could be exactly as it is, but the reference different. That generates a Cartesian problem of identification. In some of the earlier literature on direct reference and so forth, you have people worrying about this Cartesian problematic. The real problem that becomes urgent very quickly in this literature, and is more at the center of it in contemporary knowledge philosophy, is a Kantian problematic. That is, it's the question of, if you understand sense this way, how could sense ever so much as secure reference? Why is it, the actual reference of our terms, something that always goes beyond our basis for grasping things, which looks like it's always just in the realm of sense. And this raises questions then about huge literature, about how to understand the relationship between sense and reference. I mention that because it will come back. But these are just some very quick examples. That's why I'm doing these so quickly. I tried to spend a whole class doing five examples carefully. But this is just a way of indicating over and over again in philosophy you can get problems of this shape. The ones I picked, I just picked because we need some clear examples. But not because I'm saying this is where it happens. philosophy of law actually was another example I mentioned briefly, which could be elaborated. So there's many cases of this. Now, here's another claim. This is a sociological claim now, not really a philosophical claim, but I think it's also true, which is, if you look at the shape of philosophy in the late 20th and the early 20th century, what you have happening increasingly is a shift from a focus on Cartesian skepticism to a focus on Kantian skepticism. Once you notice that's true, it would take some work to show that's true, but once you notice that's true, if you think it is, that raises an interesting question, which is, why should that be so? Why is that happening? So I think, actually, if you look at the literature and philosophy of law, you'll start to notice they're getting interested in Kantian skepticism. Certainly, philosophy of language and philosophy of mind are squarely worried about Kantian skepticism. In areas like epistemology, increasingly, the pressure is in that direction. It's certainly happened in this literature that there's been a development that way. So there's an increasing pressure to move that way. Aesthetics, the cases we were discussing, was another fine example of how that tendency has taken place in the last few days. I'm not saying that when it happens in a particular area of philosophy, they're particularly noticing what's happening in other areas of philosophy and copying them. It might partly be that. But part of it is a dialectic. It's internal to these areas themselves. But so, you know, that leads to a kind of prediction one can make. In an area of philosophy where people are only preoccupied with the Cartesian problematic, wait a while. I predict, everyone in this room is young enough, I predict that within your lifetime, you will see a change in the literature. Because the tendency, the slope is now very sharp. The ice is collapsing under the sort of warding off of this problematic in areas of philosophy. So that's an interesting sociological claim. So I've just made some large claims, which we can explore later in the class, but I mention them now to let you go out. I'm sure different ones of you have worked in different areas of philosophy more than others. Try it out. See, look at the literature, look at its history, look at the problems, look at their shape, see what you find. Yes?
Well, can you just give a very short answer to the sociological claim? Why is it like that? No, I think you're true.
I will give an answer to that, okay, but not right now. Okay. We will do it through the authors we'll read. So we read Cavell and McDowell and Putnam. They have, as it were, views about this. And by thinking about their views, we'll also come to a view in the class. Mm-hmm. I'd rather do it that way. McDowell is someone we'll see has a lot to say about this in his own terms. I certainly mean to be raising questions that we will come back to. But right now, I just want people to have them on their mind. Here's another kind of thing to look out for. This is on my list of just offering things to look out for. Something I think you find in philosophy is people who, with respect, right now I've been contrasting these two varieties of skepticism, Cartesian and Kantian. But I think another interesting phenomenon is people who, across different areas of philosophy, have very different tendencies or philosophical inclinations with respect to a philosophical problematic that has exactly the same form. So let me give you an example. This is something I found particularly in Europe, so I'll mention it here. There are examples of this kind of inconsistency in English-speaking philosophy, but I think they happen in different places. But I've noticed, especially in Europe, especially in Germany, but also to some extent in France and Germany. Nobody anymore wants to be a Cartesian about perception. I don't know who gets the credit for this, if it's Heidegger or Merleau-Ponty or who exactly, but you just have to start a Cartesian problematic philosophy of perception. If you have a well-educated, you know, famous professor of philosophy at Frankfurt or Berlin or the Sorbonne, they immediately will dig in their heels. So you just start out and try to say, well, right now I might be in a classroom. I think I'm in a classroom. But I might be dreaming. So things could be exactly as they appear. And they will immediately start to dig in their heels and say, you are making a Cartesian assumption. You are assuming that there's a self-standing perceptual realm that's independent of the external world. But this assumption is disastrous. As soon as you make that assumption, you will fall into it. So there's a great deal of resistance to even trying to begin a correct perception, at least among some people. But what I also noticed is these very same people, you change the subject to philosophy of language, and you say, okay, there is a sign. Now, in order to understand the sign, I have to interpret it. But there's always the possibility of misinterpretation. Things could be just as they are. My interpretation could be very sedimented, yet I have misunderstood the sign. So what the sign means is always something that in principle could be beyond the horizon of interpretation. And what I tried to show you two classes ago, when we were discussing Cartesian skepticism, we went through this in more detail, was that problematic in philosophy of language has exactly the same structure as the problematic in philosophy of perception. You have exactly the same form of argument from illusion. You have the same gap. It's going to generalize in the same way. In the one case, you're going to concede a problematic of a certain shape to the skeptic. And if you think in perception, now I'm not taking a view right now, I'm being completely neutral. I'm not saying we should say what that German professor says about perception. Maybe he's wrong. Maybe we can concede the Cartesian that and then argue with him. And I'm not taking issue with what he says about interpretation. Maybe we're right, you know, to concede that. All I'm saying is that the problematics have the same shape, but the tendency is not to notice that they have exactly the same shape. So in the one case, one says, anything that has that shape will give the Cartesian skeptic exactly what he desires, and he cannot do that. And then to take something that has that shape and to get into a form of response that looks very much like the traditional response to the Cartesian skeptic about perception, where you say, well, yes, we might always be wrong, but, and still try to answer the skeptic having seeded something of that shape, which is exactly, for instance, what Heidegger Merleau-Ponty thinks you better not do in the realm of perception. So the point here is just the possibility of a kind of inconsistency, but it's a very subtle kind of inconsistency. There isn't a straightforward logical. It's not easy to show that someone has committed themselves to P and not P. There's not inconsistency in a straightforward thing. You have to first actually see whether you think these problematics have the same shape, something I'm claiming, especially with respect to these very quickly. But with respect to any of these two, you know, philosophical areas we discussed, if you do come to see that the problems have the same shape, you think that's right, then that does kind of create an issue about what philosophical consistency would look like across areas of philosophy. And one of the things I think is so interesting is the extent to which people don't recognize a problematic that comes back in the same form as soon as it's dressed in a new clothing. So you have exactly the same professor thinking, no, we need a view about perception where somehow we can say that in the act of perception itself, there is a way of being on to how things are that doesn't take place across a Cartesian gap. But then with respect to interpretation, they think, oh, there must be a gap always between the interpretation and the sign, the meaning of the sign, with exactly the same problem. Okay, so that's just an issue that will come up later in the class about. And one of the things we'll see with respect to our different philosophers, three of the people we're going to read, Cavell, Putnam, and McDowell, is that they are resolutely Kantian about some issues, but resolutely Cartesian in their construal of others. And that creates interesting complications. And they're trying to think through their view, and they're trying to talk to each other. conveniently, each has written about the other. So that's a kind of way of saying something about where we're going. Some other quick issues that came up I wanted to address. I'm going to do this quite quickly, too. One has to do with these labels, Cartesian and Kantian. I don't want to spend too much time on this right now, just not because it's not interesting, but because it could take a lot of time. But there's various distractions I risk introducing with these labels, and perhaps I shouldn't use them. Maybe I should just call them skepticism 1, skepticism 2. But I don't want to do that, actually, because I think there are earlier forms of skepticism. But then if you start talking about skepticism 3, it immediately makes people want to ask, well, what about 1 and 2? So why use these labels? Let me first say various things about how to understand the labels that I don't intend to commit myself to. I'm not saying the earliest you can find a form of Cartesian skepticism at all is in Descartes. I don't think that's true. And I'm not saying the earliest glimmer of a form of Cartesian Kantian skepticism is Kant. I don't think that's true. So they're not marking the philosophical birth or the first planting of the philosophical seed of either of these problematics. I'm also not saying that you can only find, if you look at Descartes, the only form of skepticism you can find in Descartes is Cartesian skepticism. In response to a question by Dixon before, I tried to say quickly why I don't think that's right. I think if you look at Descartes' worries about the evil demon or about the eternal creation of eternal truths, you have a incipient form of Kantian skepticism that Descartes' worried about. I actually have written an article about this many years ago, so I can give it to you. If you don't believe I think that, I can prove I think that. It's part of how I got interested in this issue. And I'm not saying the opposite either. I'm not saying in Kant.
Can you have that article?
Sure. I can just send it to you as an attachment. Anybody who wants it, send me an email. I'll send it to you. You don't have to read it. I'm not saying about Kant that the only form of skepticism Kant's worried about is Kantian skepticism. On the contrary, he's definitely concerned to respond to Descartes. I think, for instance, the refutation of idealism, the second edition of the Critique of Pure Reason, is his making it explicit how the argument of that book applies to what he calls the problematic idealist. That's his word for what I call Cartesian skepticism. But I am claiming that that's not the only thing that Kant is interested in, and it's not primarily or focally what he means by skepticism. Just like when Descartes uses the word skeptic, he's concerned with the thing I'm calling Cartesian skepticism. So what I do think, this is why I use these labels, and what these labels mean will only become clear in the second half of today's class. What I think is, it's with Descartes that a variant of Cartesian skepticism first becomes fully visible, that it achieves what we might call full flower, or a way of putting this somewhat more substantively is it clearly has all 9 of the features that are on the first page of this handout. It's at that point that the full shape of Cartesian skepticism is very lucidly spelled out with respect to one variant. And similarly, with respect to Kantian skepticism, there's clearly anticipations of this elsewhere, especially in Hume, of course. No accident that he awoke Kant from his dogmatic slumbers. But it's first in its systematic form and having all of these features on the second page of this handout with Kant that we have a variant of the Kantian variety. And I say a variant because then I think, as I've been trying to argue, once you start seeing what it is to have this form of skepticism, you can start seeing that it can come from many areas of philosophy. And I'm not saying about either Descartes or Kant that they raised it with respect to these areas. With respect to personal identity, with respect to issues about causation, skepticism of causation, which we didn't talk about, with respect to perception, there are a few cases where Kant clearly started to formulate a full-blown Kantian problematic. And in Descartes' case, even fewer, really mostly only perception. But I'm claiming that that we have at least a variant that fully lucidly conceived so that it has this full shape and these figures. That's the reason they get the label. So the label's working in an extremely specific way. Michel, you had a question.
Well, it's really an extremely specific way. I've thought about that. I think it's very problematic to use those terms anyhow, because in your paper, let's say the structure of argumentation is very betrayal, because you're using those terms kind of 50 or 60 times just to make a claim that they are true, and I keep on not believing that they are really valid, especially about the term Kantian skepticism. Really,
well, I'm not sure what you're saying. Here's a question which we'd have to get into Kant interpretation to talk about. But when Kant uses the word skeptic, is he raising a question about what I call Kantian skepticism? Mm-hmm. About that, I want to say yes. Generally, yes. Or the other things are for Kant ultimately to be understood as philosophical problems you can only well address by addressing the skeptic.
Yeah.
I do want to say yes to that. But you know, to have a full discussion about that would blow a large hole in the class. If you want to look at one thing, I suggest look at section 27, the coda, I would call it, the deduction of the B edition of the Transcendental Deductions, the concluding session. There he says, he gives the example of cause and effect, but I think it could be any of the categories. That's just an example. I think there even is a zum Beispiel there when he introduces it. And he says, if you take the form of necessity involved here to be a form of necessity in which one's saying, one cannot help but think, we are so made, either by custom or by God, so that we cannot help but conjoin the effect of the cause. Then you give the skeptic what he most desires. This is the one place he actually uses the word skeptic in the whole Transcendental Deduction.
Yeah.
And he says, if you did that, you would reduce all, you would be left with a position where we have at most an illusion of objective validity. And then the question is, what is an illusion of objective validity? And if you follow that out, you're going to be led back to passages like the one I quoted at the beginning, where he says, if we lack the categories, there would be no unity. There would be no objective validity.
Yeah.
There would be no presentations that give things true or false. We would have less than a dream.
But that's my claim. He is kind of answering Hume's skepticism by let's say, defining the categories, because Hume is worried about causality, and Kant is just
claiming
that causality is existing, because a priori, that's it. So that's not skeptic at all. That's an answer to skepticism. That's trying to overcome it by what he calls criticism.
Well, you're confusing various things here. First of all, I'm not saying Kant is a skeptic. More than I'm saying Descartes is a skeptic. Both the terms Cartesian skepticism and Kantian skepticism are labels for the problem that each of these philosophers addressing. So, but Kant certainly thinks Hume is a skeptic. Even Hume thinks Hume is a skeptic. one of the few. people who think that about themselves in the history of philosophy. And then the question is, what kind of problem is that? I do think Kant thinks that he's clearer about what Hume's problem is than Hume was. Hume thinks he can, as it were, localize his problem to certain, Kant would say, to only some of the categories. Causation was one of the things that Kant wants to show, is that when Hume says, we have an impression of a red triangle, that of already imports objective validity into our characterization. That is not a bare Empfindung. That is a Vorstellung. And if we can analyze the character of that Vorstellung, we see it will have both intuitive and a conceptual aspect. So that if we really think through Hume's skepticism all of the way, we won't just have experience that lacks causal unity, but will possess these other forms of unity Hume wants it to have, and then bootstrap itself up. If you really think through Hume's skepticism all the way, what you have is a problem about how experience, the deliverances of experience, could so much as give us any form of unity, the kind of skepticism I was talking about when I talked about Kantian skepticism about perception last class. And the task in Kant is to try to explicate how it is, what the conditions of the possibility of our experience having that kind of unity, even as I put it, the unity of a false judgment.
Yeah.
So an illusion of objective validity is an illusion that we could so much as even have experiences that are of a shape that could present themselves as being true or false. That's what objective validity means there. So I think it doesn't fit. He does give a very clear gloss on Cartesian skepticism. That's about, given that we have representations of inner sense that have this unity, how can we know that there could be a genuine faculty of outer sense that presents things as they are in the world and not just as they are in us? That's the Cartesian problematic, where things can seem a certain way, but how can we know that things outside are as things seem inside? It's a completely different characterization of that than he does when he's responding to this generalized problem of human skepticism. I think they're clearly distinct in Kant. Kant thinks you have to address this form of skepticism, the generalized human skepticism, which leads to, for Kant, Kantian skepticism in various areas, including perception. I'm claiming even more areas than Kant realized, but here's the basic idea.
Yeah.
And that it's only through a discussion of that that you can then have the resources for addressing the Cartesian skeptic. And, you know, I'll say this even very quickly. The response to the Cartesian skeptic is, you couldn't even have what you think you have, namely perceptions that seem to be of something, unless you already had more.
Yeah.
So you either have to have less or more, but you can't set up the problem the way you want to set it up. That's the strategy of the Kantian response to Cartesian skepticism, which requires that you address this kind of skeptic first.
Yeah, okay.
So that's very fast. You don't have to be convinced by it.
Okay, I'm not, but I really understand what you told me, absolutely, but I just wouldn't call it Kantian skepticism. I wouldn't call it pragmatic, really.
Well, what
it
is
it? Maybe I'm stupid, you know, but it provokes confusion, you know?
Well, if you want to know what Kant means by the word skeptic, you want to look at things that have the shape of handout 2, not handout 1. That seems to me a reasonable reason for calling that. That's my answer. Okay, so now, quickly, a couple of other items of business, and then we're going to stop and have a break. There was another question Miguel asked last class, which I wanted to start to answer briefly, or at least maybe what I should do since we've spent a lot of time is at least get the question out clearly, which is, here's a different kind of worry about calling these Cartesian skepticism and Kantian skepticism. Michael right now has been complaining about calling this Kantian skepticism, but here's another worry you could have, which he also had at one point, which is, okay, it's Kantian, but should we call it skepticism?
Yeah.
Okay, but that's another worry that one could have. I think a good worry. Here's why one might have that worry. You might think, especially if you focus on Cartesian skepticism as your model, you might think, well, what skepticism is a problematic which has to do with knowledge. Skeptics are people that doubt we have a certain kind of knowledge. Knowledge about the past, knowledge about the external world, knowledge about other minds. And skepticism issues in a doubt about the possibility of that knowledge. And then if that doubt cannot be overturned, then the skeptic wins. The skeptical doubt turns out not to be answerable. If it can be, then we have an answer to skepticism. So it's very natural to think of skepticism as having that shape. If you're introduced to it in a Cartesian format, you might think that's a necessary feature of skepticism. If you think those are necessary features of skepticism, then you're right to conclude that what I'm calling Kantian skepticism, if you really get clear about what it is, you'd be right to conclude that's not a kind of skepticism. Because if you think clearly about Kantian skepticism, it no longer is directed peculiarly at knowledge. That is, it's just as much a problem how you could have false experiences as true experiences. It's not a question about how do we know which experiences are true. And indeed, if you start thinking it through, it's just as much a problem about how we could have a determinate, contemptful attitude of doubting as it is how could we have one about knowing, or for that matter, one of dreaming. How can we so much as dream anything? It's just as much a question in philosophy of perception as how can we know that we truthfully perceive something. So once you start noticing this aspect of the problematic, it can start seeing like this isn't skepticism anymore. It's ceasing to lose the character of skepticism because the problem is so basic, it's not allowing us to draw the Cartesian line between the dubitable and that which is invulnerable to them. Those attitudes like dreaming, having things seem a certain way, doubting, which can take place on this side of the Cartesian gap, and they have a kind of self-transparency for the performer, and things like how things really are in the world, how things are inside Richard's mind, how things are in the past, the things that are on the far side of immediate Cartesian acquaintance. That gap itself, both sides of it become problematized, the near side as well. So I think this is a reason, it's a reason someone could say, this is no longer a form of skepticism. And I just want to make it clear. If you want to say, this is not a form of skepticism, each of the Kantian variants, because they don't have those features of the Cartesian variants, then I'm not saying, yes, you must call it skepticism. That seems to me a pointless argument. That would just be a kind of linguistic stipulation on that point. So all I want to say about that is, call it what you want, as long as you don't confuse yourself. But there are reasons for calling this skepticism. One reason I am going to claim is if you want to know what Kant means by the term skeptic, or you want to know what Kripke means by the term skeptic, or you want to know what Wittgenstein means by the word skeptic, then if your model is Cartesian skepticism, you will misunderstand them. We will see that in respect to those cases later in this class. So I'm not trying to legislate how the word is used. I'm just pointing out the word gets used across these varieties, and we want to be able to keep clear. We don't want to just assume that because it's the same word, it must have a Cartesian shape. That's one thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is, if there turns out to be a systematic relation between these two varieties of skepticism, that would be a further reason why this wouldn't be an arbitrary word to use. If these things have nothing to do with each other, and it's just sort of an enormous category mistake to conflate this problematic with that problematic, then it is a little easier to take up the position. Don't call that skepticism. So that's a question, a philosophical question we need to investigate in the course, which is, what is the relationship between these two varieties? And one of the things we're going to look at is various philosophers who have, I think, implicitly taken views on that question. And as I was suggesting very briefly to Neil, I think Kant had views on that question. And so, depending upon what your view is on that question, I think bears on this question how appropriate terminology is. There are underlying philosophical issues. I don't want to prejudge them. That's why I'm flagging this issue. But I want to point out that they can't be decidable in a minute. Let's take a break and then come back and start working the handout. So see you in 10 minutes, is that right?